Hello, 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 and welcome to the Local Edition. On this Monday evening, I'm your host, Patricio Roballo. Jason Dole has the night off. We have a packed show for you tonight. We'll hear from New York Focus about how Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill is affecting New York's climate and sustainability policies. We'll also learn about how Sullivan County is tackling the ongoing housing crisis. And before all that, we'll start in Monticello, where law enforcement held a press conference today about multiple ghost guns seized in Liberty. But before we dive into all that, I just want to take a moment here to say thank you. Thanks to all who have supported us during our summer fun drive. Not only have we reached our goal, we exceeded it. And that's because of you. And if you haven't heard, Congress has defunded public media, cutting support for stations like ours. You can read more of that on our website. Congress has cut 25% of our budget. It's a tough time, but what has gotten us and what has gotten me really through this weekend were the messages that we have come alongside the donations. And I just want to share a few. One listener wrote, having Radio Catskill's local news and information source threatened by our own federal government is alarming. And that's why I'm donating, to keep it alive. Another said, we've been listening to WJFF for over 20 years. And thank you for being a beacon of reliable local programming for the Upper Delaware communities. And another listener simply said, WJFF is our lifeline for information, connection in these frightening times. Courageous, courageous, keep going. And reading those messages over the weekend, I keep getting alerts on my phone. Every one of them reminded me of why we do what we do. And like Jason says in the promos over the weekend, Radio Catskill will be here as long as you are here for us. So if you want to continue supporting us, you can visit our website, wjffradio.org, and make a donation. Or if you can't make a donation, tell people about the station. Share our Facebook. We're on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, LinkedIn, YouTube. Share it, like it, tell your friends. All right, let's get into tonight's show, and let's go to Monticello, where a press conference was held today. The Sullivan County's District Attorney's Office held a press conference today in Monticello. It was about a stolen property complaint in Fallsburg that led to something much bigger, a raid in Liberty that uncovered a cache of illegal firearms, including five ghost guns, and two people were arrested and now face multiple felony charges.
Some of the firearms seen here would be legally possessed by individuals without a felony conviction. Others, particularly those classified as assault weapons, are outright prohibited under New York state law.
That's Liberty Police Chief Steve DeGatta, who says the weapons were discovered inside a North Main Street residence in Liberty, and a vehicle used by the suspects, Derek McCosco and Kimberly Moran. One of the most alarming findings were ghost guns, which are untraceable and privately made firearms without any serial numbers.
Ghost guns are a growing driver of violent crime. These unserialized, privately manufactured firearms are untraceable and easily obtained by individuals who are legally prohibited from possessing weapons. Because they lack serial numbers and ownership records, they are increasingly used in shootings, gang-related violence, and other criminal activity where avoiding detection is sought by criminals.
Sullivan County District Attorney Brian Connerty said the threat of ghost guns is especially dangerous because of how easily they are made and transferred, often with no oversight.
The ghost guns can be made anywhere and transferred to anyone without any governmental oversight, including to convicted felons, children, and those too mentally unstable to safely possess the same.
Investigators say McCosco, a convicted felon, and Moran flaunted their weapons on social media, behavior made them both a risk to public safety and a target for criminals.
Individuals such as Darren McCosco and Kimberly Moran that make Sullivan County less safe by flaunting this illegal weapons possession on social media in the face of all those who struggle to keep up and maintain with the changing gun laws, thereby making himself and herself a target for violent burglaries and robberies by other criminals in their pursuit of these guns. At bottom, illegal weapon possession, especially of ghost guns, severely undermines the public safety of this county.
Both suspects were arraigned and remain in Sullivan County Jail. The investigation is still ongoing. But DA Connerty had a clear message.
These crimes, including those committed by Darren McCosco and Kimberly Moran, will be investigated and prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
Radio Catskill will keep on top of this story. So let's move on to New York Focus. On the phone with us now is Colin Kennenborough, a climate reporter for New York Focus, to help break down his recent article, The Race to Build Solar and Wind Before Trump's Tax Credit Deadline. So, Colin, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here.
So let's give a big picture here. You know, President Trump has this newly passed legislation, which he's calling the Big Beautiful Bill. It's putting enormous pressure on states to sort of speed up their renewable energy projects. Let's start walking through, you know, the weeds of permitting policy and what's going on here. Exactly what does this deadline mean for wind and solar in New York?
Yeah, I might start by taking this just one more step back here, mm-hmm. and reminding people the context we were in before this bill was signed a few weeks ago. As people might remember, one of President Joe Biden's signature policy achievements was something called the Inflation Reduction Act, which, among other things, extended tax credits for solar and wind energy into the 2030s, along with lots and lots of other kinds of energy that were going to be supported under this legislation. Fast forward to 2025, Trump enters office with a stated goal of cracking down specifically on solar and wind, you know, painting them as unreliable and expensive, you know, going after offshore wind in particular. But there was sort of this open question as to whether these tax credits would actually get repealed. Because a lot of these projects were happening in redder Republican districts, and people thought that Congress might not actually end up going after them, but they did, and they just left open a, you know, in the end, what they did. I mean, the mission here clearly is to you know, essentially end the tax credits, but they left open a slim window. This was the compromise in the Senate at the last minute, a slim window of essentially 1 year for projects to still get built and earn these tax credits and claim these tax credits. And keep in mind, you know, these tax credits generally pay for about a third, almost a third of the cost of a project. So that's a pretty, you know, core part of their financing, without which a lot of them would not be able to move ahead, or at least would have to completely rethink their financings. So yeah, so here we go. They now have until July 4th of 2026 to get shovels in the ground to still qualify for tax credits. They don't have to finish by then. There's a separate deadline that would allow them to finish by the end of 2027. And you know, there's a push from the industry to kind of have states help developers meet these deadlines and get shovels in the ground, which at least in New York, which is, you know, a highly regulated state, is usually a years long process. So I'm happy to get into some of the challenges in more detail here.
Yeah, no, definitely. You know, we both experienced planning board meetings and how that process does take long. This sort of walk us through the process, and also if you know how many projects this was actually affect. You know, I'm sure that there's different projects in different stages of development.
So I think something people need to keep in mind is that there are, you know, a few core things that you need to build, you know, a wind or solar farm, which are true anywhere, but there are some, you know, New York has its kind of own specific version and quirks. So one of them is a permit. You know, you need, first of all, you need land, you need access to the land, you need either to own it or to lease with people. You need permits from the state generally, or from a local municipality to build on that land. And then you also need some kind of contract, you know, to guarantee that someone is actually going to buy that power once you've built the facility. And in New York, usually that goes through something called NYSERDA. It's the state's energy research and development arm, which essentially guarantees wind and solar developers that they will be able to earn a certain amount of money off these projects in the long term once they're up and running. So that involves some level of subsidy from the state and from utility customers. So you need all of those things, and each one of those things can be really tricky to get in New York. The state actually made some reforms a few years ago to try to make the permitting process easier. Oh, and I forgot one other crucial part. You also need to be able to connect to the grid, and that requires going through the grid operator, which is actually separate even from the state. It's an independent nonprofit known as the NYISO, and you know, they have to do all these studies to make sure that your project isn't going to cause some issues in the grid, and if you need upgrades in order to be able to connect, how much you're going to pay for those, and so on and so forth. So that part is also crucial. So you need all of these ingredients. And all of them are pretty challenging to get. The permits, we're supposed to be moving faster on this since some reforms a few years ago, but it still takes years to get permits. And sometimes that process is not synced up with the other things. And so altogether, it can take, you know, usually, I mean, in the range of 5+ years and often longer, to get from A to Z. I mean, 5+ years, I think that's on the conservative side. I think it's closer to like 6, 7, 8, for many of these projects to get built. And you asked about numbers. One thing that really struck me reporting this article was learning that even projects that have been permitted, that have gone through this often years-long process to get their permits to build, the overwhelming majority of them have not been built yet or have not even started construction yet. And I'm still trying to understand all of the reasons why. There's a few I could get into if you'd like, but that really struck me. I mean, the overwhelming amount of the projects that New York has permitted, we're talking about 3 gigawatts worth that could that could power hundreds and hundreds of thousands of homes, are not yet built.
Right. Now, first of all, let's go over the reasons why some of them are not built, but it also seems like this deadline is going to put a hold, or permanent hold, on a lot of potential projects coming up. If they have, at least less than a year now, to get all their ducks in a row.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Besides the ones that have been permitted, and, there are 26 of those that I was able to count that are kind of pending right now. One under construction and then another one that is complete. Besides those, there are many more in the queue to get their permits, and various others that are at other stages of development. So it's at this stage very unclear which of those will go ahead. I kind of zoomed in on this cluster of projects that has already gotten their permits because, you know, that's, as I mentioned, that's one of the key ingredients here. It kind of seems like some of the lower hanging fruit as far as projects that could potentially start construction within that 1 year window. And just to add in one more wrinkle here, I know there are already a lot, but to add in one more wrinkle, things actually get more complicated, even though it's a 1 year window, starting at the beginning of 2026. So kind of halfway through the window, there are some new requirements that come in at the federal level in terms of what kind of materials they're allowed to use, essentially restrictions on Chinese components. So that makes things even more complicated. So really the best bet for developers is to try to start building before the end of this year. But definitely a tall order in a state like New York. And I mean, I'm sure anywhere, but especially in a state like New York, where these projects usually move on a several years long timescale.
And I guess just to talk about politics here, I guess Trump's goal is to sort of, tie up all these projects so these projects won't get built. Is that fair to say, or?
I think that's pretty fair. I think the Trump administration and some of its allies in the House Freedom Caucus in particular have been very vocal about that their goal is to just kill as many wind and solar projects as possible. I think one of the Republicans was quoted as saying that, you know, he expected that, especially with a separate executive order that Trump added on after adding yet more complicated rules, that essentially 90% of pending wind and solar projects would get canceled. So this is really a question about kind of which can still squeak through, like which handful of projects can still make it, and whether that's going to be really any in New York. And it seems to me from my reporting, like, and from talking to people in the industry, like, there are still projects that hope to get through, but, you know, they would kind of need some backing from the state to actually make that happen.
Right. And what has been the state's response to this?
They have not said a lot so far. The Hochul administration, Hochul's office told me that the governor was directing a multiple agency wide review to see what could be done, essentially, just to look at the impacts of this bill on energy specifically. So we'll see what comes of that. It's possible that, they could do a quick review and say, oh, here are all these steps we could take to make this happen. But they've generally so far struck a pessimistic note, saying the state just can't fill the gaps after if this federal money goes away. So it's really not clear. One thing I would mention just for people to keep in mind is, on a separate track, you know, there appears to be this revived gas pipeline project that that is moving forward in the state that has been put on a very quick, this was a project that the state decided not to move ahead with several years ago. It was long fought over, and that suddenly is back on the table after Hochul had talks with the Trump administration. And that seems to be moving very quickly through the kind of environmental review process, with just a quick 30-day review. Just to point out, there are ways that the state can expedite these things when it chooses to. And I think what the industry wants to see here is that, you know, Hochul makes renewables a priority as well.
Right. You have this quote from the Alliance for Clean Energy New York that if it says from Marguerite Wells, if we're cutting red tape for other forms of energy, we should cut red tape for renewable energy too. In saying that what you just said, so that means that the state still has some power to have some of these projects go through, even though Trump's sort of bottlenecking the whole process.
It looks that way to me. I can't say definitively, but I think there are definitely openings, and the renewable industry is definitely pushing the state to move some of those things across. I mean, you asked about why some of these projects that already have permits, for example, aren't going through. And one thing I noticed was, you know, some of them are still going through sort of secondary stages of, or I don't know if it's second or third or fourth or fifth or what, but, you know, additional environmental review where they have to get water quality certificates and that kind of thing. And it's conceivable that the state could speed up things like that. They also, a lot of them, I mentioned contracts, you know, which usually also go through a state agency, or technically it's an authority, NYSERDA. And a lot of these projects don't have current contracts. They did have contracts in the past, but they got canceled after the pandemic and inflation kind of blew up their finances, and they kind of had to go back to the drawing board. A lot of projects have gotten new contracts since then, but a bunch of them haven't. So there's a chance. I mean, NYSERDA has been promising to issue a new round of bids that would allow some of these projects to get new contracts. That was supposed to happen. I mean, that's supposed to happen any day now, but it's really a little bit unclear what's going on at NYSERDA right now, with all the uncertainty coming down from the federal level. So still waiting to see whether they move ahead with that at all.
Now, I'm wondering how tariffs will plays into this, because like you mentioned even in your article that, you know, a lot of these components to build these let's say solar or wind farms come from China.
That is true. A lot of them still do. I mean, more and more of the supply chain is in the U.S. And I think, you know, developers have made an effort, and there are still, you know, incentives for people who are using more U.S. made materials. So I don't have a definitive read on how much the tariffs are going to affect things here. A lot of solar components also are actually no longer coming from China, I think, because there's kind of been a punitive approach in general. There have been tariffs even before Trump towards Chinese solar components. So a lot of those are coming from, I think, Vietnam. I couldn't give you the full list of countries, but other countries. So honestly, I don't have a clear sense of how much that's affecting the picture. I think my big picture sense is that the tariffs as they stand right now, which is a lot of them are in limbo, it, you know, wouldn't in themselves be a killer, but losing these tax credits potentially could be.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Colin, before we go, is there anything else that we have not touched on you want our listeners to know about?
I think we covered this pretty thoroughly. I mean, I think one other thing I might mention is that I find the industry remains kind of surprisingly bullish in a lot of ways. Of course, they were very disappointed with the way things went down with the big bill in Congress. But a lot of them keep making this argument that as long as there is demand for energy, you know, we're going to keep building renewables because they're needed. And it's just going to get more expensive. So I think that's definitely something I'm going to be watching. You know, are some of these projects going to keep getting built even without the tax credits? And what is that actually going to do as far as our energy bills? Yeah, just so much happening in this space right now, more than I can keep up with, but doing my best here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Colin, I think you're doing a great job to sort of break out down all this regulations and policies that now the solar and wind projects have to go through. We were talking to Colin Kinnenborough, climate reporter for New York Focus, talking about the new deadline now imposed on these solar and wind farms in New York. Colin, thank you so much for talking to us. I do really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you, Colin, and thank you, New York Focus, for that report. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back and we'll learn more about how Sullivan County is looking to tackle the housing crisis. This is The Local Edition, and I'm your host, Patricio Roballo.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Welcome back to The Local Edition on a Monday evening. I'm your host, Patricio Roballo. Sullivan County continues to face an urgent housing crunch. According to a 2024 study by the Hudson Valley Pattern for Progress, more than 3,500 renter households are cost-burdened or severely cost-burdened by housing costs. The Sullivan County Legislature must now decide how to address this issue. Last year, the legislature allocated $2 million in local funds for affordable housing. Now they must decide how to spend it. There are a few options on the table. Develop a housing trust fund, build new affordable rental housing, or repair and rehab existing housing stock. Radio Catskills' Kimberly Izar spoke with Heather Brown, Sullivan County's Commissioner of Planning, Community Development, and Environmental Management, about the different options on the table and what could it mean for the county's housing supply.
Sullivan County has $2 million in appropriated county funds that it needs to spend for affordable housing in the county. They allocated these funds, I believe, sometime last year. They felt that affordable housing was an urgent issue. What are the different options that the county legislature is considering for how to spend that money?
So to get to that, I'm going to back up just a little bit to last year, 2024. And in the fall, the Sullivan County legislature voted and approved a local law that established affordable housing as a county purpose. And I think it's important that when we talk about affordable housing, we kind of identify what we're talking about with affordable housing. So the word affordable basically means 30% or less of any individual's gross annual income is housing that is affordable to them. And then you need to decide who the demographics are going to be that you're targeting to make housing affordable to. So that's one of the items that they're kind of grappling with right now. So we engaged the Hudson Valley Pattern for Progress to help us to structure a program of what this could look like if the county were to actually fund with local funds, flexible local funds, a housing program that sought to expand affordable housing opportunities in Sullivan County for a variety of individuals. What we've come up with are two different tracks. One that would be for rehabilitation of rental units, and one would be for new construction of rental units. For the rehabilitation of rental units, we'd be looking to target households that are at or below 80% of the median household income. For the construction of new rental units, it would be targeting folks who are at or below 60% of median household income. So those are the two programs that have been presented to the legislature for them to consider if they want to go after one, if they want to go after the other, or if they want to give themselves the flexibility to have both kind of on the books.
Right. And you mentioned the report from the nonprofit Hudson Valley Pattern for Progress. I took a look at that report. There's a lot of great information that's in there, including about how the rising cost of housing outpaces wages. Can you expand a little bit more about some of the key findings in the report that also informed your approach to affordable housing?
So in 2022, and this actually goes back to before I became commissioner for the Division of Planning, planning had commissioned a housing strategy, the 2022 Sullivan County Housing Strategy, which was completed by a firm called CZB. And as you could expect, 2022, we're coming out of the pandemic. Things were starting to really ramp up. A lot of different pressures on the housing markets. Things were starting to get a little bit crazy. And we were realizing in that study that, there was certainly this kind of lack of housing stock for first-time home buyers that were affordable, and this lack of units for folks who are kind of at the upper end of that workforce housing, that 60 to 80% to median household income, which was basically causing a logjam in our housing stock and the way that housing stock typically flows. Hudson Valley Pattern for Progress came in about a year and a half, 2 years later, and started to update those numbers. And as bad as those numbers were in 2022, they had gone really bonkers by the time that Hudson Valley Pattern for Progress had gotten involved. Last fall, I believe the median home sale price in Sullivan County eclipsed $300,000 for the first time in history. We've never had a median home price go that high before, but that is where we currently are hovering, just above that $300,000 number. So it kind of showed where this gap was and who are the people that we're talking about. When you talk about 60 to 80% to median household income, we're talking about the workforce of Sullivan County, the folks who provide the services that we all rely on, whether we're a business or a resident or a visitor, rely on these folks to provide critical services. Grocery clerks for our tourism industry, you know, you're talking about, you know, the food services industry, which is huge in Sullivan County, of course, during the summer months and anytime really. You're talking about mechanics, you're talking about home health aides, which is a really big deal given our rising senior population. So they were really kind of able to dig down into who are the folks who are becoming housing stressed in Sullivan County and who are the folks who are really struggling to locate, you know, healthy, affordable and reliable housing for themselves. And it's hitting our working class particularly hard right now. That was kind of what the impetus was for deciding that we wanted to take a hard look and see if there was a role for Sullivan County to address some of this, this pressure.
Yeah. And I remember during the county legislative meeting, there was something that really stood out to me about condemned housing properties being one of the key contributors to the housing crunch, largely in part because of the lack of repairs for dilapidated rentals. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Sullivan County, we do have an aging housing stock. If you compare Sullivan County to some of our other counterparts in the Hudson Valley, our housing stock is considerably older. And given, you know, whatever circumstances, you know, homeowners may have, you know, that housing stock has not necessarily been maintained over the years. So we do tend to lose housing stock to dilapidation. What we're trying to identify as an easy way to, not an easy way, but some reliable way, I should say, to quantify that dilapidation outside of just the condemnation numbers, because a lot of time you see that a property isn't actually formally condemned. You just kind of look, there's a house that's, you know, falling down, the roof's caving in, and maybe that house has not been formally condemned by the municipality, but certainly it's not livable. And one of the items that was addressed by the Pattern for Progress, one of the items that was brought to our attention is that Sullivan County, more so than our neighboring counties, has a tendency to lose housing stock to lack of maintenance, to dilapidation, and that only exacerbates an already high-pressured kind of situation.
I want to ask also about the possibility of developing a housing trust fund. I know we talked about, you know, building new affordable rentals or repairing and improving existing housing stock. I believe that there was some mention of a housing trust fund. Can you kind of just explain what that is? And if that's something that's still on the table?
Sure. I would first say that I think all of these programs are still on the table. And a housing trust fund, the difference between a true housing trust fund and what could also be like a one-off kind of county program is that a trust fund has a dedicated source of revenue that will replenish that fund annually or as needed. So that would require the legislature to actually identify a source of revenue that they're going to say in the future, you know, this many dollars or this much percentage of these collections will be put into this fund specifically for the purpose of addressing affordable housing needs in Sullivan County.
Thank you, Kimberly, for that report. You can find more on our website. That does it for the Local Edition on this Monday evening. I have been your host, Patricio Roballo. Thank you so much for joining me. You can still donate to the station. Check out WJFFradio.org. Check out all the news stories that we have done. Sign up for the newsletter, listen to the podcast, and support us. I've been your host, Patricio Roballo. Lucy, have a good night. Everyone else, take care. Stay safe.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Forestburg Playhouse, presenting Disney's Newsies, July 29th through August 10th, the rousing musical inspired by the real-life newsboy strike of 1899. Tickets at ForestburgPlayhouse.org. And from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at Sullivan180.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Seasonal folk songs, recent releases, traditional songs about country and city life, the finest songwriters. Rebecca Littlemonk is with me, Graham Rice, is bursting with folk music from Britain and Ireland. Sunday afternoons at 3 on Radio Catskill.